Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again, and welcome back. On today's As It Is program, we will be talking trade and politics. The Obama administration says the recently negotiated Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal would boost U.S. jobs, but it's facing a hard sell with Congress and candidates campaigning to replace President Barack Obama when his term ends. With details of how things stand, here are Mario Ritter and Anna Mateo.
More candidates running for president oppose the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal than support it. Democratic frontrunner Hillary Rodham Clinton is the latest to declare her opposition to the deal. The TPP was negotiated by the Obama administration. As Secretary of State, Clinton described Obama's TPP as the gold standard of trade agreements. But this month, she said the final deal does not appear acceptable. "I don't believe it's going to meet the high bar I have set," she said. Senator Bernie Sanders, Clinton's top challenger for the Democratic presidential nomination, opposed the agreement. He maintained that stance even before the deal was finalized. "We need trade policies that promote the interests of American workers, not just the CEOs of corporations," he said, after 12 nations announced agreement on the Pacific trade deal October 4th. Republican presidential candidates are divided. Businessman Donald Trump, Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal, and former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee opposed the deal. Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, Florida Senator Marco Rubio, and Ohio Governor John Kasich are mostly in support of the agreement. Others, including former Surgeon Ben Carson, said they are waiting for more information before expressing a view. But the U.S. Congress will likely vote to accept or reject the deal long before the winning candidate takes office in January 2017.
The trade agreement eliminates or reduces tariffs and other barriers to trade among 12 nations. Ministers from Australia, Brunei, Canada, Chile, Japan, and Malaysia approved the deal. It was also approved by ministers from Mexico, New Zealand, Peru, Singapore, the United States, and Vietnam. The approval came on October 4th. Congress has never voted against a major trade deal. The TPP might lack support from U.S. politicians who are running for president or who are trying to keep their congressional seats. Many U.S. businesses support the trade deal. They say it will export more of their products to Asian markets. But unions fear job losses and cuts in wages and benefits if the trade deal is approved. Democrats are very much interested in the support of unions, and the labor movement is opposed to this deal, said Brian Brocks, a political science professor at Tulane University. He said that most voters may not understand the complicated agreement, but many are likely to see it as being helpful to big businesses rather than American workers. Also, many Republicans are not inclined to support a proposal by President Barack Obama, a Democrat. That makes it harder for a Republican candidate for president to support an agreement his administration negotiated. For Republicans, Candidates not supporting something backed by President Obama is never a bad idea, Brox said. In other words, voting against Obama's projects is good for Republicans. Trump tweeted comments about the deal that played to Republican primary voters opposed to President Obama. He tweeted that the Obama administration was incompetent. TPP is a terrible deal. Rubio, the Florida senator, said he wants to see more details before taking a firm position. However, he told CNBC, "I'm generally very much in favor of free trade."
The Trans-Pacific Partnership sets rules for investments from one country to another. It includes protections for intellectual property, such as patents and computer software. The deal covers more issues than is the case with some free trade agreements. It is basically a free trade agreement on steroids, Columbia University International Economics lecturer Andrea Bubala said on hashtag VOA. U.S. Trade Representative Michael Froman said the trade agreement will improve the U.S. economy. It will allow more U.S. products to be exported than foreign products will be imported to the U.S. U.S. products face tariffs as high as 70% on autos, 50% on machinery, and 700% on certain agricultural products, Froman said. Eliminating or reducing the high tariffs will make U.S. products more competitive, he said. I'm Mario Ritter.
And I'm Anna Mateo.
You are listening to VOA from Washington. Reducing some climate pollutants could save millions of lives, says a new report by the World Health Organization, the WHO. Gases like soot or black carbon, methane, and the ozone in city smog are called short-lived climate pollutants. As we hear from Ann Ball, not only do they contribute to climate change, but they can cause ill health.
WHO says emissions from these climate pollutants cause cardiovascular and respiratory diseases. These include heart disease, pulmonary disease, respiratory infections, and lung cancer. The WHO says these pollutants are responsible for many of the more than 7 million premature deaths each year that are connected to air pollution. The UN Health Group also says the pollutants can decrease agricultural crops. These pollutants exist both outdoors and indoors. WHO Environment Chief Maria Nera says the pollutants have a strong impact on climate change. She says the good news is that they only stay in the atmosphere for a few days to 10 years. That is much shorter than carbon dioxide, a greenhouse gas, that can remain for hundreds or even thousands of years. WHO has a number of available and affordable ways to mitigate these short-lived climate pollutants. At the top of their list, cutting vehicle emissions by requiring higher emissions and efficiency standards. More emissions are released when engines are running. Indoor air pollution also contributes to bad health and premature death. The WHO reports that nearly 3 billion low-income households rely on dirty fuels. Coal, wood, and kerosene used for cooking and heating are examples. They say cleaner and more efficient stove and fuel alternatives could cut down on the health risks. The WHO report also calls for encouraging high and middle-income populations to include more plant-based foods in their diets. It says this could reduce heart disease and some cancers. It could also slow the methane gas production that comes with some animal-sourced foods. I'm Ann Ball.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
How can I help you? How long has it been hurting?
These are among the sentences that medical students are learning at the Enrique Cabrera Medical School in Havana, Cuba. Graduates from the medical school practice medicine in Cuba, as well as in countries in Africa and South and Central America. Juan Carlos Dominguez Lopez is head of the English department at the school. Professor Lopez says that medical students begin by learning how to ask about the patient's problem. They learn questions such as,
"What can I do for you? Where does it hurt? Can you describe your pain? Are you taking any medication?"
Future doctors also learn to use the command form of verbs like,
"Sit down. Tell me about your family history. Hold out your arm." The most important tool for learning about English medical language is real-life experience, according to Lopez. He says students go along with doctors to visit patients in the university's hospital or clinic. On these rounds, the students observe how doctors and specialists talk with patients, discuss each case, and make reports. The value of this real-life experience is to connect theory to practice. Students learn theory in the classroom, but find out how doctors help patients in the clinic. For example, students may learn germ theory, the idea that germs cause disease. But as they follow doctors, they may see how often the doctors wash their hands and how they wear masks and gowns or scrubs to prevent infection.
As students become more advanced, Lopez says they learn the English grammar structure reported speech. Reported speech is how we tell others what someone else said. When doctors write a report or talk with others, they use reported speech.
The patient said that she has had 2 children.
In addition to learning from real-life experience, students at Enrique Cabrera Medical School read and listen to articles on medical topics from VOA Learning English and watch videos.
Professor Lopez says Cuban students prefer to practice American English rather than British English. After all, Cuba and the United States are neighbors, only 90 miles away from each other. As the relationship between Cuba and the U.S. improves, Lopez hopes that more student scholarships and courses in the U.S. will be available for his students. Already, he has taken training at the U.S. Embassy on the Test of English as a Foreign Language, or TOEFL, which is required for international students entering American universities. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm John Russell.
Welcome.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. South Carolina withdrew from the United States on December 20th, 1860. The state seceded because a Republican, Abraham Lincoln, had been elected president. The Republicans were a new party, and Lincoln was the first to be elected president. They wanted to stop slavery from spreading into the Western territories. Southern states believed they had a constitutional right to take property, including slaves, anywhere. They also feared that any interference with slavery would end their way of life. This week in our series, Frank Oliver and Larry West tell what happened after South Carolina left the Union.
South Carolina faced several problems after it seceded. The most serious problem was what to do with property owned by the federal government. There were several United States forts in and around the port of Charleston. Fort Moultrie had fewer than 70 soldiers. Castle Pinckney had only one. And Fort Sumter, which was still being built, had none. The commander of the forts asked for more men. Without them, he said, he could not defend the forts. The army refused. It told the commander to defend the forts as best he could. He was told to do nothing that might cause South Carolina to attack. If South Carolina attacked, or planned to attack, then he could move his men into the fort that would be easiest to defend. That would probably be the new one, Fort Sumter.
The governor of South Carolina planned to stop any movement of federal troops. He ordered state soldiers to stop every boat in Charleston Harbor. They were to permit no United States troops to reach Fort Sumter. If any boat carrying troops refused to stop, the state soldiers were to sink it and seize the fort. 6 days after South Carolina seceded from the Union, the commander of Charleston's forts decided to move his men to Fort Sumter. They would move as soon as it was dark. The federal troops crossed the port in small boats. The state soldiers did not see them. The governor was furious when he learned what had happened. He demanded that the federal troops leave Fort Sumter. The commander said they would stay. The governor then ordered state soldiers to seize the other two forts in Charleston Harbor. And he ordered the state flag raised over all other federal property in the city.
President James Buchanan, who would leave office in just a few months, was forced to deal with the situation. His cabinet was deeply divided on the issue. The Southerners wanted him to recognize South Carolina and order all federal troops out of Charleston Harbor. The Northerners said he must not give up any federal property or rights. The president agreed to meet with three representatives from South Carolina. They had come to Washington to negotiate the future of federal property in their state. The Attorney General said the meeting was a mistake. These gentlemen, he said, claim to be ambassadors of South Carolina. This is foolish. They cannot be ambassadors. They are lawbreakers, traitors, and should be arrested. You cannot negotiate with them.
The Attorney General and the Secretary of State threatened to resign if President Buchanan gave in to South Carolina's demands. The President finally agreed not to give in. He said he would keep federal troops in Charleston Harbor. And he said Fort Sumter would be defended against all hostile action. On the last day of 1860, he ordered 200 troops and extra supplies sent to Fort Sumter. The War Department wanted to keep the operation secret. So the troops and supplies were put on a fast civilian ship instead of a slower warship. It was thought that a civilian ship could get into Charleston Harbor before state forces could act. But a Southern senator learned of the operation. He warned the governor of South Carolina. When the ship arrived in Charleston Harbor, South Carolina soldiers were waiting.
The soldiers lit a cannon and fired a warning shot. The ship refused to stop. Other cannons then opened fire. The commander of federal troops at Fort Sumter had a difficult decision to make. He had received permission to defend the fort if attacked, but his orders said nothing about defending ships. He knew that if he opened fire, the United States and South Carolina would be at war. The decision was made for him. South Carolina's cannons finally hit the ship. The ship slowed, then turned back to sea. It returned north with all the troops and supplies.
The commander of Fort Sumter sent a message to the governor of South Carolina. "Your forces," he wrote, "fired this morning on a civilian ship flying the flag of my government. Since I have not been informed that South Carolina declared war on the United States, I can only believe that this hostile act was done without your knowledge or permission. For this reason, and only this, I did not fire on your guns." If, the commander said, the governor had approved the shelling, it would be an act of war, and he would be forced to close the port of Charleston. No ship would be permitted to enter or leave. The governor's answer came back within hours. He said South Carolina was now independent. He said the attempt by the United States to strengthen its force at Fort Sumter was clearly an act of aggression, and he demanded that the commander surrender.
During the crisis over Fort Sumter, Congress tried to find a compromise that might prevent war. Lawmakers proposed a new line across the country. South of the line, slavery would be permitted. North of the line, slavery would be illegal. Many Republicans supported the proposal, even though the Republican Party opposed the spread of slavery into the Western territories. One Republican, however, rejected the idea completely. He was Abraham Lincoln, who would take office as president in March. Lincoln said there could be no compromise on extending slavery. If there is, he said, then all our hard work is lost. If trouble comes, it is better to let it come now than at some later time.
The trouble would come soon. One by one, the states of the South seceded. By February 1st, 1861, six states had followed South Carolina out of the Union. A few days later, representatives from the states met in Montgomery, Alabama. Their job was to create a new nation. It would be an independent republic called the Confederate States of America. The convention approved a constitution for the new nation. The document was like the Constitution of the United States, but with major changes. The Southern Constitution gave greater importance to the rights of states, and it said there could be no laws against slavery. The convention named former United States Senator Jefferson Davis to be president of the Confederate States of America. Davis did not want civil war, but he was not afraid of it. He said, "Our separation from the old Union is complete. The time for compromise has passed. Should others try to change our decision with force, they will smell Southern gunpowder and feel the steel of Southern swords."
Jefferson Davis left his farm in Mississippi to become president of the Confederate States of America on February 11th. On that same day, Abraham Lincoln left his home in Illinois to become president of the United States. As Lincoln got on the train that would take him to Washington, he said, "I now leave, not knowing when or whether ever I may return. The task before me is greater than that which rested upon our first president. Without the help of God, I cannot succeed. With that assistance, I cannot fail. Let us hope that all yet will be well."
The program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Frank Oliver and Larry West. Transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts of our programs can be found, along with historical images, at voaspecialenglish.com. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.